Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking to the author of Leadership Organizations in the House of Representatives, Party Participation, and Partisan Politics. The book is published as a part of the Legislative Politics and Policymaking series by University of Michigan Press. Scott Menke, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well.
I mispronounced your name after we had that long conversation. It's Scott Menk.
That's correct.
Good. Scott, after that brief mistake, tell me about yourself. Tell us all about where you are now before we get to talking about your interesting book.
Sure, and thanks for having me with you today, Heath. I've been looking forward to this. I am an associate professor of political science at Bucknell University, which is in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. My PhD is from Ohio State, and the published work that I've done before the book project has been focused primarily on Congress. I've done some work on congressional representation and the electoral connection, as well as some work on congressional parties and congressional history. So Congress has been my main focus, although I've done some collaborative work on presidential selection processes and on the Supreme Court as well. At Bucknell, I'm sort of the all three institutions Americanist, and so I've done a little bit of research in all three areas. But for the last 5 or 6 years, most of my attention has been on things related to this book project.
Well, it sounds, I imagine, familiar to a lot of people listening about wearing those multiple institutional hats. This book is about Congress, and your subtitle has lots of peaks: party, participation, partisan, and politics, but no policy. Would you tell us a little bit about what a congressional party committee or a policy committee is? That P that's not in the title but is relevant here, and what this has to do with a whip organization. Just sort of maybe you can define some of the terms before we start talking about this.
Sure. So each of the parties in the House of Representatives, the Republican Conference and the Democratic Caucus, has in addition to its top elected leadership, the Speaker, the Majority Leader, the Minority Leader, has a set of party committees and party organizations that help with the day-to-day operation of the parties. And each of those organizations involves many members, many rank and file members of the party. In the day-to-day operation of the party. In each party, you have whip organizations, which are led by the majority and by the minority whip and by a few chief deputies. The Republican whip organization and the Democratic whip organization involves dozens of appointed whips that help to collect information and disseminate information through the conference or the caucus. On the Democratic side, there is a Democratic Steering and Policy Committee, which has existed since the mid-1970s, and it has the standing committee assignment function for the party, but also at times has been an important center for deliberation and coordination within the Democratic caucus. The Republicans have a steering committee that houses the standing committee assignment function for the Republicans. They also have a policy committee that has at times had an important role in distributing information and in coordinating in the short term on policy initiatives. There have been some other organizations that I talk about a little bit in the book, the Republican Research Committee, which existed until the 1990s. And there are also other organizations that are important, like the Congressional Campaign Committees that I've set aside for the book because they operate in a different way than those other organizations that I just mentioned that are the main focus.
Now, why it seems on the one hand kind of obvious, but why would a member like to be on one of those committees? And why would House leaders want to invite more members to join them?
That's a great question, right? The focus of the book is sort of how the collective party interests that the leadership is trying to pursue intersect with the individual goals of members who are participating. From the perspective of the top leadership, ever since the 1970s, the party leadership has seen an interest in having rank and file members involved, right? It allows the top leadership to more effectively carry out the coordination tasks that the party has to carry out, the exchange of information and getting on the same page strategically that the leadership needs for either party to function. It allows a better and more cohesive, persuasive process, particularly within the WHIP organization. And it has come to have an important role for the top leadership in facilitating external communication, both to the party's reelection constituency outside of the House and sort of a two-way flow of communication between members of the House party and external party actors. So from the top leadership's perspective, all of these things are benefits that allow the top leadership to carry out its difficult tasks more easily. From the perspective of individual members, those who decide to participate and who are invited to participate gain in a number of different ways, right? Those who have an interest in policy from the perspective of their individual goals have the opportunity to pick up information about policy and be involved in the increasingly important party process, party portion of the policy process, right? More peace. They benefit in advancing on the career ladder. I show some evidence in the book that that most of the members who step into a top elected position do so from a post, an appointed post in the extended leadership. They benefit also from a constituency perspective, and I show some qualitative evidence and a little bit of quantitative evidence in the book to demonstrate that some members choose to make their involvement in the party part of their home style, part of how they present themselves to the constituency. And so this connection and this participation in the party becomes part of how they show themselves, particularly for those members who are from more partisan districts, to be a good Republican or a good Democrat. And finally, they get some benefits that the party is able to distribute. I show that even when we control for other factors that influence standing committee assignments, that those members who are involved in the party extended leadership do better in advancing in prestige committees within the House. So there's individual member benefits, and there are great benefits to the top leadership in trying to carry out its challenging tasks.
Now, much of your book is about the difference between how these organizations were used in the past versus more recently. What is the time period that you study, and is there a dividing line between the past and present? When do we see the change that you study starting to happen?
So the time period for the book starts around the mid-1970s, starts in the immediate post-reform era, and the research extends into the mid to late 2000s. And I argue overall in the book that in the late 1970s and early 1980s, as these organizations came into their modern form, especially in the majority Democratic caucus, that the organizations were used in a more open way to try to facilitate very broad participation. This is at a time in the late 70s and into the 1980s when the Democratic caucus was pretty diverse, but conditional party government conditions were strengthening and there was greater demand for centralized party leadership. And so as the leadership's trying to meet those demands despite a diverse caucus, it found that it was very useful to bring members into organizations like the Democratic Steering and Policy Committee and use that as a place for discussing policy and strategy, and then also to use the WHIP organization in a way to bring a very diverse set of members into the process to allow the leadership to gather information and to connect better with the different corners of the Democratic Party. This is a story that is familiar to some congressional scholars, I imagine, because it's a story that David Rohde and Barbara Sinclair have told in some form in their studies of that time period. And my archival work on the Democratic organizations in that time period shows something similar. But I also found that the same thing was true for Republicans in the minority in the 1980s. That especially the Republican Policy Committee was used to try to bring a lot of different Republicans to the table to consider policy in the short term and to try to reach some consensus about policy that the party wanted to put forward and some strategic coordination as well. So the Republicans were sort of intermittent in their use of the Policy Committee during that time, but you saw again this kind of inclusive approach. You asked, you sort of, is there a dividing line? Do we see where this changes? And I argue in the book, you sort of have this first stage in the late 70s and into the 1980s where party government conditions are strengthening, the party organizations are becoming more important to both really Republicans and the Democrats, but those organizations are being used in this more open and inclusive way. I think as party government conditions become even stronger into the late 1980s and the early 1990s, and as especially as electoral competition heats up around the 104th Congress and after, that's a point in time where we see a real change. We see that the organizations that were responsible for persuasion and coordination, the WHIP organizations and the policy committees, become less representative of the full range of views in the party. They have become dominated by loyalists. This is particularly true of the WHIP organizations, also of the Republican Policy Committee. It's not that the party organizations then sort of fall into disuse, but that they are more tightly controlled. The WHIP organization is used for persuasion and coordination and is more tightly under the control of loyalists. And then the top leaders use the other organizations that remain not so much as forums for deliberation, but for information sharing with party actors outside of Congress and for transmitting partisan messages. And so these institutions become adapted to a changing political climate starting in the late 80s and the early 1990s.
Now, you had the enviable task of combing through the archives of some real congressional legends, both Republicans and Democrats. Whose archives did you examine, and where were some of the places you got to go to collect this data?
This was a lot of fun. Up until working on this book, I've been mostly a number cruncher as a congressional scholar, and there is some number crunching in the book, but a lot of it is based on archival work. And the bulk of the information on the Democratic Party came from the Foley papers, which are located at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington, and from the Tip O'Neill papers, which are in Boston. I spent a lot of time with both of those sets of papers, in part because they span most of this time period. And because both of those leaders were very good about retaining a lot of the documents about what these organizations were doing. I looked at some other Democratic papers, including the Bonnier papers, which are at Wayne State University in Michigan. David Bonnier was nice enough to let me take a look at those papers before they were open to the public. And I got some information from the Gephardt papers and the Wright papers as well. But O'Neill, Foley, and Bonnier were the main sources. On the Republican side, Bob Michael's papers, which are at the Dirksen Center in Illinois, was the main. So those were the main source for the Republican side, because he too had kept a great deal of information about the Republican organization. He had been involved, way back into the 1960s and up into the 1990s. He had a lot of staff files that were helpful. Files about what the policy committees were doing and the steering committee. I spent some time in Norman, Oklahoma, looking at some of the papers there, and I was able to look at Mickey Edwards' papers. He was a Republican leader who was involved in the research committee and the policy committee. Dick Armey's papers there were also helpful. As you said, a lot of big names, a lot of legends, but I should also mention that some of the things that I found that were the most interesting and sometimes the most unexpected were in papers of members who were a little bit more obscure or who you don't associate as much with the party leadership. I went on something of a whim to Bud Schuster's papers in Pennsylvania and found great information on the Republican Policy Committee in the 1970s and 1980s and learned some things that I just did not know about what the Policy Committee was doing. Again, Mickey Edwards, who was not a very high-profile leader in the 1980s, had great information as well. So this was a lot of fun.
And what did you find? What did the archival research tell you that a quantitative study, a primarily quantitative study, could not?
Well, first and foremost, I wanted to know what these organizations were doing on a regular basis, exactly what kinds of activities they were involved in, and who was participating and how, and the existing work, with the exception of the Rohde and Sinclair books that I mentioned earlier, just really didn't tell us much about that. There really wasn't a good answer to that question in the literature. So I was looking at things like minutes of meetings, agendas for meetings, people's schedules, trying to kind of see what was happening. And I was able to see, for instance, I was able to track in the case of the Democratic Steering and Policy Committee, agendas and minutes over many years, seeing that those meetings in the late 70s and the early 1980s usually involved a substantial strategic and policy component and discussion, where the rank and file were talking with committee leaders and with leadership and getting on the same page, and that there was a dramatic fall off in that by the late 1980s, by about the time that Wright became speaker, where that steering and policy committee became almost exclusively at that time concerned with committee assignments and virtually nothing else. And so by looking at what was going on within these documents, I was able to see what they were doing in a way that the literature had not previously revealed. There were also just, you know, as I was mentioning before, unexpected finds. In addition to the big story that I was looking for, there were unexpected finds. There were memos in some cases outlining exactly how the organizations had operated in order to achieve a particular outcome. A lot of that kind of thing in the O'Neill papers. I found a file that was practically the holy grail for me in the Foley papers, that was an extensive analysis that the Democrats had conducted of their own whip organization in the 100th Congress to quantify how well each of the 80 odd whips were doing as whips and how the whip organization had done overall in doing its whip work. I found memos that from staff to leaders and from leaders back to staff discussing what they were doing and why they were going to do it. Some of those even talked about how the leaders' own goals related to why they were making the choices they were making. So it was fun to find not only the kinds of things that I went to look for, but also those serendipitous moments of stumbling upon things that I never expected to find.
Now, what does this all have to do with polarization? We've all heard of the increasing polarization of Congress. Do these new leadership strategies that emerge that seem to focus on loyalty and discipline, does this relate at all to polarization? And if so, how?
I think it does, right? I think polarization is a key part of this story, that what we're seeing in the story I was telling a few minutes ago, through the late 1980s, early 1990s and beyond, with increasing polarization and cohesion and electoral competition, is, as congressional scholars have often said, an increasing willingness of the rank and file to delegate authority to the top leadership and to let them take more control. And congressional scholars have had a lot to say about how that works in things like the operation of the Rules Committee to control the agenda on the floor, right? That's a very familiar element of how polarization has worked and has manifested itself in Congress. What I think I'm able to show in the book is that beyond that kind of basic agenda control that is the keystone of party power, if we look at the day-to-day operation of the party as a set of organizational structures, we can also see how that tightening of top leadership control narrowed the scope of participation, changed the way that the party communicates internally, and in a way that advantages for a time, or at least did seem to advantage for a time, the leadership and the rank and file, right? The leadership gets a more loyal whip organization that it can rely on more confidently, and the rank and file get their greater connections to this strengthened party that has more power to reward them, right? And so, you know, there are benefits on both sides to that manifestation of polarization within the congressional parties. But there's also, to answer a question that I guess you didn't ask, right, there's also a trade-off here, which I think we've begun to see in the last few Congresses for Republicans, where that very tight control of the party as organization makes it a little bit more difficult for the leadership to maintain close connections and close relationships with all the corners of a conference that begins to fracture. And it also should be troubling in a certain way, if I can be a little bit normative about it, in that as the party has become more, of the center of policymaking in the House, you have the party sort of weakening its own internal structures, like the policy committees that had played an important role in sort of the competence of the parties in the policy realm. And that I find a little bit troubling about the story that I told.
Yeah, the book again is Leadership Organizations in the House of Representatives, Party Participation and Partisan Politics. The book is published by the University of Michigan Press. Scott Mank, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Heath.